Good morning, everybody, and a big welcome to our program this morning. It's Super Saturday at Flemington, one of the great days of racing, and I thought it would be rather appropriate that we talk to the Executive General Manager of Racing at Racing Victoria, and the man who handicaps the thoroughbreds and all the major races here in Victoria, in Greg Carpenter. Good morning to you, Greg.
Good morning, Brian, and you're right, looking forward to a really great program at Flemington this afternoon.
And it is one of the real jewels in the crown of our autumn racing, and it's a pretty stiff opposition against New South Wales, but we hold our own and we really hang out for a day like today, don't we?
Well, absolutely. I think the Newmarket is still seen as the great sprint test in Australian racing, the 1,200-metre handicap down the straight at Flemington, and some really exciting horses this afternoon. The quarterback trying to go back-to-back, and Extreme Choice, the three-year-old. And the Australian Cup is always a great race as well, and glad that we've got a Caulfield Cup winner in Jamaica this afternoon. So it's a really strong support program, and looking forward to some really exciting racing.
The days of 24 runners up the straight in the Newmarket handicap seem to have been gone. The numbers are down to about half that today. It's still an intriguing race with the great unknown of the inside-outside and where's the best ground up the middle. That's all part of the intrigue of racing.
It is. I think you touch on a very interesting point. The days of the great charge of 24 horses down the straight at Flemington are probably a sign to a bygone era. We don't seem to quite get the big fields with horses splitting completely inside and out. But you're right, the general modus operandi nowadays with the older horses to try to come down the centre of the track. And I always think it's interesting that horses closer to the grandstand side seem to be able to get a bit more momentum up on the outside. So that might favour horses like Terra Vista and Extreme Choice, but it's always generally a very fair contest down the straight. And we've certainly seen some exciting finishes. Some of the higher weighted horses and some of the performances in the Newmarket over the last decade have been outstanding. I mean, Black Caviar winning her race in such quick time with 58 kilos, and the following year Haylist giving weight to Buffering and winning with 58.5 in a photo finish were two of the great moments of Newmarket racing history, and it has provided some really outstanding finishes over the time.
Just tracking back through your career, you commenced in racing administration with Western Australian Turf Club in November of 1981, and you quickly rose to racing manager and chief handicapper in 1989. And then in 1995, you were appointed chief handicapper for the Malaysian Racing Association, which controlled racing in Singapore and Malaysia. An interesting time over there. I see you became director of racing in Singapore and Malaysia in 1998, and then back to Perth in 2000, so 5 years out of Australia. What was that like?
It was really interesting. It was a great family experience. We moved to Kuala Lumpur, which was the main centre of racing in Malaysia. At that time, there were four tracks in Singapore and Malaysia. Kuala Lumpur, which was the Selangor Turf Club, Penang, which was always a nice place to visit with the family when they were racing up there, and Ipoh. They were the three Malaysian tracks. And then, of course, Singapore. And when I went there in 1995, they were racing at the old Bukit Timah race course quite close to the centre of the city. So in those days, they used to race 16 weekends of the year in Singapore, Saturday, Sunday, the following week, Saturday, Sunday, and then the show would move on somewhere else. And there were 12 weekends in Kuala Lumpur, Penang and Ipoh. So there was a lot of travelling. And it was really interesting. It was great for a person from Western Australia who had really only been exposed to Australian racing to move overseas and experience what most of us understand now is the globalisation and internationalisation of horse racing in Singapore and Malaysia. A lot of the horses came from Australia and New Zealand, but there were European horses, there were American horses, a lot of South African riders, trainers from all over the world, including French and English trainers. So for me, it was a great lesson that the Australian way wasn't the only way. Whether it was riding horses or training or even administration, there were plenty of different ways to get a positive outcome. Mm-hmm. And of course, the 5 years that I was there was a great growth and expansion period for Singapore racing, which was also very exciting the last 18 months that I was there.
I remember going to the old track at Bukit Timah. In fact, the day we went, there was no racing. It was a meeting where there was something coming from either, might have been KL or Ipoh, and I couldn't believe it. The stands were packed, the betting was furious, and we went up and sat on the stands and watched the big screens and watched a race meeting that was hundreds of miles away.
Well, in those days, the only way to have a bet at the four tracks in either Malaysia or Singapore was to be on course. In the late 1990s, they started opening up off-course betting facilities in Singapore. But you're right, if they were racing in Malaysia, there would still be 20-odd thousand people that would go to Bukit Timah because that was the only place that you could bet on the races. And as I said, the first 3.5 years that I was there, every week there would be trucks of horses go from Singapore across the border through Johor Bahru and either through to KL, further on to Ipoh, or right up across the bridge to Penang. So there would be lots of Singapore trainers and horses competing across the three tracks. What happened in about 1998 up there was the Nipah virus, where there was an outbreak of horse sickness in Malaysia. So Singapore closed the border off to protect their horses from illness. And that really led to the separation of the two countries from a racing point of view. Jockeys still moved, but the horses didn't as much. And it was a very exciting time to be involved with the Singapore Turf Club, because they were definitely looking to improve their racing. We built the new race course out at Krungi, which is a world-class facility even to this day. We started changing some of the races and modernising them. There was very little focus on three-year-old racing. The Singapore Derby, when I went up there, you know, the first year I was there, I think a nine-year-old won it for the second time, and he'd run in it three or four times. So we certainly looked at my experience here in Australia, but also in Hong Kong, to try and make some rapid improvement in Singapore. And eventually that did lead to the opening of the Krungi race course in 1999, and eventually the first international race in Singapore, which was held in March of 2000.
The Singapore Gold Cup has been a great success over the years. Mummify, I think, went there a few years ago and won the race, and it got great recognition with its prize money and sponsorship. So it came a long way in a pretty short time, didn't it?
It did. As I said, when we first had our international race in 2000, ESPN came and broadcast it to people all over the world, and I was very lucky to be part of that broadcast team with a great larger-than-life American broadcaster called Chris Lincoln, who used to go around the world and do all the broadcasts in Maidan, well, anyway, Dubai and some of the tracks in America. So that was a landmark initiative for Singapore. And what a great night that was. It was won by a local horse called Uzo. Malcolm Thwaites was the trainer. Jay Simey was the rider. And it beat a champion French horse who was travelled there called Jim and Tonic. Jim and Tonic had been very successful in Hong Kong, and campaigned around the world. So for a locally trained Singapore horse to win the very first Singapore International Cup was a great result. What has happened since Mummify up there was probably more than a decade ago now. It kept going, but with the introduction of the casinos into Singapore, the wagering market has been quite challenged up with the Singapore Turf Club. And unfortunately, in 2006, they made a decision to no longer have the Singapore International Cup. So the Singapore races are now only for Singapore-trained horses. I hope that someday they'll reopen themselves up to international racing. But still, the standard of prize money, trainers, jockeys and facilities in Singapore is still very, very strong.
And we've got world-class riders here from Australia riding out of Singapore, your Michael Rods and Glenn Boss and people like that. And the training ranks are so strong as well. Interesting that Michael Friedman, who was very successful up there, came back, had a short stint here, has now got a licence to train in Hong Kong. So it's a moving feast for a lot of these guys, isn't it?
It is. Michael was up there for a number of years and was very successful. When I was up there from 95 to 2000, John Maher relocated here from Melbourne. I mean, he'd been so successful with What a Nuisance winning a Melbourne Cup and Ready to Explode and those sorts of horses. And John went up there and he had a very long and successful career training out of Singapore. Laurie Laxon, who had trained Empire Rose to win a Melbourne Cup, also relocated to Singapore, and Laurie's still there and training really well. We've mentioned Michael Friedman, Cliff Brown, who won a derby here in in Victoria went up there, and he's been up there for a number of years now. And even an ex-jockey from Australia called Steve Burridge, who actually went up there and didn't get a licence until he'd been there for a few years. He's also had a very long and successful career in Singapore. It's great to see people like Michael Rodd, who's, you know, one of the great jockeys there in Australia and a really terrific ambassador for racing. He's riding well up there, and you mentioned Glenn Boss. And, of course, Corey Brown was up there for a number of years, and he's come back. So it's a good lifestyle for trainers and jockeys in Singapore and Hong Kong. And it's great, I think, always to see Australian riders and trainers go over and be successful internationally, because it is very competitive.
Looking at your career, you seem to do things in five-year blocks. You had 5 years in Singapore. You came back to Perth in 2000 as director of racing at the WATC. Industry racing manager over there in WA and racing and wagering in 2004. But in 2005, a very important move for you to come from the West to come to Melbourne, appointed chief handicapper for Racing Victoria and responsible for the first year for you, 2005, of weighting the Caulfield and Melbourne Cup. And this is Mackay Bediva going for a third Melbourne Cup. So talk about weight. There's a bit of weight on your shoulders.
Well, I don't think, Brian, I actually realised the enormity of the role until I arrived. If you go back to the history of the Melbourne Cup, first run in 1861, there's only been nine individuals that have had the role of chief handicapper, the privilege of constructing the weights. And for me personally, it was quite daunting to think that Kevin Ryan, one of the great handicappers of all time, had done 20 Melbourne Cups, and he was followed up by Jim Bowler, who did 25 years. So I was only the third guy to do the role in 45 years. And absolutely, I think one of the very first interviews that I did in January 2005 was, what weight are you going to give Mackay Bediva when she comes back to try and win a historic third Melbourne Cup? And look, I'm always very open about the work that I do. I try and explain the decisions that I make. And when I talk about the Melbourne Cup and how great a race it is, and Mackay Bediva and how great a racehorse she was, I openly acknowledge there will be people who think that I should have given her more weight. Certainly it's not my role to get a horse beaten in the handicap. But for her to actually tackle that race for the third time and be successful and become only the first horse to win the race three times, it was not only a great moment in Australian racing history, but a great moment in Australian sporting history. Mm-hmm. And to be there on the racetrack and to be just a very small part of that whole day and the lead up to it, I think it was, for me personally, very good, but it was a great moment for Australian sport.
It's interesting, the handicapper prior to you, Jim Bowler, who had a wonderful career in the world of racing here in Victoria with his weight allotments for the feature races and 25 years, as you said. He gave Mackay Bediva 55.5 in 2004, and you lifted her 2.5 kilos. But you'd be very conscious of the fact that she had to create history, A, to be the first to win three Melbourne Cups, and create a weight-carrying record for a mare.
It was. When you construct the weights for the Melbourne Cup, you're always looking back for historical precedents. And as I said, I was trying to give her a weight which I thought she could win with, even though it was going to be still an enormous challenge for her, but also very conscious of the other horses that were going to be there on the day that needed to be have a winning opportunity. So it's, I think, one of the most intriguing or one of the most interesting parts of that whole story for me was that leading to the race, whether they were playing a game or not, there was always no total and absolute commitment from the connections that she was going to run. And I think probably one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had on a racetrack was the 2005 Cox Plate, where they all took off going past the school and they were eight across the track. And, you know, I think Excellent, the great New Zealand four-year-old, was the widest of them. And she came away and won the Cox Plate in one of the most memorable races of all time. And at that point, I actually didn't think that they would run her, because I thought, after that performance, what else is there to achieve other than setting yourself up for a fall? But, you know, the story's been told by Lee Friedman that they, you know, looked at her in the week leading to the Melbourne Cup. She worked beautifully for Glenn Boss, and they made a decision to run. And like he had done previously, Glenn just gave her a perfect ride in the race. And when she came through that gap at about the 350-metre mark, you could see that she was going to win the race. Honor Jeune was flying home and Excellent was there in the finish, but you know, she won that race quite comfortably.
She did, and it was probably one of, when you reflect back on running her in that third Melbourne Cup, it was probably one of those great racing gambles, wasn't it?
It was, as I said, to win two Melbourne Cups, you know, it's been done very few times in the history of the race, for a mare to carry 58. But again, she did everything right through the preparation. And I think it was great, as I said before, for racing and sport that the connections continued on, took up the challenge, and that she was able to come through and do it on the day. I think we've been very, very lucky in the last decade here in Victoria. And it's strange that the majority of them have been mares, but to see horses of the calibre of Maccabi Diva, I know some of your great calls prior to that was, you know, Sunline winning a Cox Plate, but she was a New Zealander, Sunline. But in the last decade, certainly some of the great Australian mares in Maccabi Diva, Black Caviar and now Winx have delivered some of the great moments in racing. But it was a great day. The following year, the Japanese came and everyone said that the race was going to change forever. Delta Blues and Pop Rock singled the way from the rest of the field, and in a photo finish, Delta Blues won the race from Pop Rock. The great moment after the finish line where Damien Oliver congratulated Iwata, the Japanese rider, who probably wasn't sure that he'd won or not. And I think the last 12 years, for me personally, it's just been a great privilege to be involved in the Melbourne Cup. And the race just continues to evolve and continues to capture the imagination. We used to say of Australia and New Zealand, but I think it's a great draw card now and a focus for racing right around the world.
No question of that. My guest this morning, very interesting to catch up with Greg Carpenter. And we'll be back after this commercial break. We're here for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating life. Greg Carpenter with me this morning on This Is Your Racing Life. And you mentioned about the race perhaps changing forever. And it did change forever in so many ways back in 1993. We're talking about the Melbourne Cup. When that canny Irishman came out here with Vintage Crop, and that was Dermot Weld, and we knew that Vintage Crop had good form, but it had been in jumping races, and we had trouble getting our head around that, but it didn't matter on the day, did it? The rain came, it was well before you arrived here, and Vintage Crop powered away, and the race did change.
Well, the race did change, and the whole world has changed. I think there's far more interest now in international racing, and people know the form lines so well. There were actually two horses that came out that first year. Vintage Crop, who was a last start winner of the Irish St. Ledger, but the more favoured and more highly weighted runner in the race was a horse called Drum Taps, who had been so good in some of the European lead-up form. And interesting, it was before I arrived. I remember I was guest speaker at a Rotary function that day in Perth. Melbourne Cup race day at Ascot in Western Australia is always a big day, but with the time difference, I actually spoke at a Rotary function that morning and talked about Drum Taps more particularly than Vintage Crop. As I said, his form actually was very strong, though. He was a last start winner of the Irish St. Ledger. He had 55.5, and even though we didn't know a lot about Dermot Weld at that stage, he certainly was very successful and has been a trailblazer, really. He's won big races around the world. So he was also very good at travelling horses before he decided to bring Vintage Crop out here. The race has changed. It was the start of European horses coming to Australia. And certainly I think that has accelerated over the last decade. In the last 5 or 6 years, you know, we've had anywhere between 8 and 11 horses run in the Melbourne Cup that have been internationally trained each year. But I think a lot of credit goes back to David Burke, the chairman of the VRC at the time, who travelled overseas with Les Benton and Jim McGrath, you know, a race caller and commentator in Europe, went to Dermot Weld and tried to convince him to come out, and he accepted the challenge. We've expanded it out beyond just Ireland and England now. The French have come and they've won the race with Americana and Dunedin. The Germans have come. Protectionist won it for Andreas Waller. We've mentioned the Japanese. I suppose the last frontier, Brian, is still to try and get an American horse out here. But as we know, staying races in America aren't always that strong. But the main challenge in actual fact is quarantine. And we're still working on trying to get a quarantine facility, and we might have a success on that space either this year or next. So,
also the fact there with the American horses, the fact that so many of their major races are run on dirt, and if you come here for the Melbourne Cup, you're on turf. So is that a bit of a drawback?
It is. When you look at some of the best horses in the world last year, Arrogate and California Chrome, you're right, their big races are on dirt. There is a strong racing circuit on turf, but generally the turf tracks are on the inside of the dirt track. They're only a mile and an eighth or 1,700, 1,800 metre courses. They are starting to try and build some staying races. We had one horse entered last year called De Big Hoss, who had pretty good form. Of course, Rosedale came out many years ago, I think owned by Nelson Bunker Hunt, perhaps, but certainly trained by Bart Cummings, and he ran third in a Melbourne Cup. So there are American horses who would be up to the mark, but we've still got to get that quarantine right. But you're absolutely correct in your assessment that their main focus is on dirt racing, and they still haven't got an absolute focus on races beyond really 2,500 metres. Even the 2,500 metre races are a bit of a rarity.
We're 8 months away, basically, from the Melbourne Cup and the Caulfield Cup, of course. They're the handicap races, the Cox Plate run at weight for age, so you don't have to worry about doing the weights for the Cox Plate. When do you start? When do you start looking at, obviously now with what you can sort of watch through all different avenues and different platforms, you can watch every international race, basically, and get it online. Which is a great tool for guys like yourself. So when do you start looking at perhaps who may be coming? I know the scouts, Lee Jordan and people like that, are looking for horses to come here. When does it start for you?
Well, the construction of the weights, in actual fact, is a 12-month process, because what I actually do within a week of the carnival finishing Cup week, go through all the horses that ran in the Cup, horses that might have run in the Caulfield Cup and not made it through, the Derby winner and the Oaks winner, and start thinking about where I might put them in the handicap the following year. And that's just not the winner and the place getters. There are horses like Who Shot the Barman that keep coming back every year and are very competitive. But, you know, as they get a year older each year, you've got to think about trying to give them some relief when they've tried three times and haven't been able to win, even though they might run a really good race and be competitive. They probably need some additional relief in the weights the following year. So as far as the document that I have, the draft of the Melbourne Cup weights, it's a living document that I go back to very often throughout the year. So from a domestic point of view, the horses that run in the Spring Carnival, the Derby and the Oaks winners, then we look at the Sydney Carnival, New Zealand, of course, although what I'd have to say, and it's not disappointing, but the focus of New Zealand racing has changed, as it has in some respects on Australian racing. Their breed has changed. We're not getting the same number of New Zealand bred stayers coming across to the Cups, but certainly still very mindful of the New Zealand form. So that's Australasia. And then I've been very lucky to be part of the World's Best Racehorse Rankings Committee. There are 18 major racing countries in the world. The head of handicapping in each country represents their jurisdiction on that. We talk about the best racehorses and the best races that are run throughout the world. We have a dedicated website where every Group 1, Group 2, Group 3 race, the results are on there within a couple of days. And we all put our ratings in for all those races, particularly the Group 1. So you've got a pretty good knowledge of what's happening around the world. It's very easy to speak to your counterparts in the different countries. And as you say, Brian, with the live broadcast of racing internationally now, it's easy to watch it live, or you can record it, watch it the next day. And even a thing like YouTube is so marvellous that within a couple of days you can go back and watch really whatever replay you want to. So Lee Jordan, you're right, he's done a great job getting horses out here. In the end, we probably get 25, 30 that come for the carnival each year, but there are a lot of horses in the world, and I try and keep an eye on as many of the horses that I think might come out for a Caulfield and Melbourne Cup as I can. The Cox Plate is a weight for age race, but you know, it's starting to get a lot more attention internationally. We've had really good high-class horses come over the last few years. Adelaide won it for Ireland. Highland Reel was placed behind Winks and Criterion. And, of course, last year, Vadamos, the French horse, went hard early, looked as though he was going to drop out and still fought on in the straight and ran top four. So those sorts of horses in the Cox Plate are really good because it gives us a nice measuring stick for horses like Winks. And it also allows us to give a little bit of vindication to the ratings that I put forward for our Australian horses on the world scene.
You're in your 12th year and your tenure as chief handicapper and also representing Australia for the world's best racehorse rankings. It must be very gratifying to see horses like Black Caviar achieve world's best. Chautauqua rated the best sprinter in the world at one stage. And now what Winks is doing. You must be very proud.
Well, I actually think that probably the recognition that Australian horses have got on the world scene over the last decade is probably my biggest contribution to racing in my career. It's not been as a result of me. It's been the achievements of the horses. But when I started on that committee in 2005, there were seven horses from Australia who achieved a rating of 115 or higher. Now, for last year, we had 50. We've had more than 50 horses a couple of times. And generally, the watermark every year is about 40. Now, to give your listeners some sort of indication, 115 is seen as a genuine Group 1 performance in the world. At the end of the calendar year, all the horses from around the world who have achieved performances of 115 or higher are published, and that's generally about 310 horses each year. So for Australia to have 50 horses in that list is a great achievement. For us to have 22 of the top 100 Group 1 races in the world run here in Australia is a great achievement. And for horses like Black Caviar to be four times champion sprinter in the world, the highest ever rated mare in the modern era, is a big achievement for Australian racing. And it's been great that Winks has also now been given a similar mark for her eight-length victory in last year's Cox Plate. So it's wonderful that Australian horses are getting that achievement. I think one of the things that Peter Moody said was that I don't know why I have to take Black Caviar to prove how good she is. And I disagree with Peter on that, because Australian horses don't have to travel now to be recognised on the world stage. One great example was So You Think. When he swept through those weight for age races as a four-year-old, he'd won the Cox Plate as a three-year-old, but then he won all those races as a four-year-old leading to the Cox Plate and then won the McKinnon. He was rated 126 here in Australia, and he was given that rating internationally. And then the following year, he went and campaigned in America. He did run in the Breeders' Cup, but he campaigned in Europe and won Group 1s there. And he achieved a rating of 126 there. And Black Caviar was given ratings of 130, 132 for her wins here in Australia. She should have been more rated more highly for her bravery when she won at Royal Ascot, but certainly it wasn't her best performance. And her best performances were from her in Australian wins. So Australian horses are now given the recognition that they deserve on the world stage. It's been a lot of hard work putting in ratings for every major race around the world, advocating and arguing on behalf of Australian horses. But I think one of the keys has been European horses coming here for our spring carnival, coming here for our Cox Plate. That gives a great form reference for our own horses. And I think personally, as the championships continue to evolve in Sydney and they start to get more international horses, the flow of horses around the world and the level of interaction with the competition just gives everyone more confidence that the ratings are holding up.
Giving Black Caviar in 2011 58 kilos in the handicap in the Newmarket, I think that's probably her greatest performance that I saw on the time that I called it.
Well, it's interesting. Let me explain to our listeners. I'm head of handicapping here in Victoria, but we have a really hard-working team who have their own levels of responsibility. So the sprint races have been done by, when Black Caviar and Haylis won it, by Neil Jennings. Neil left us 2 years ago and he's travelled now. He's on the handicapping team in Dubai. So he gave Black Caviar 58 when she beat Crystal Lily and gave those horses a lot of weight and won that race. The following year, I know John McNair, there was a lot of public commentary about Haylis getting 58.5. So it was a great result for Neil to get that photo finish, and Haylis beat Buffering, who then went on and won so many Group 1s and won internationally. And since Neil's gone to Dubai, David Hagen, who's been with us for more than 10 years now, he's taken up the role as the sprint handicapper. Got a really good result last year with quarterback Black Heart Bart and Chautauqua running third with 58 when Chautauqua ran a very short price favourite. And he's released the weights this year for the new market for the second time. But again, I agree with you. Black Caviar performance was outstanding. It wasn't a handicap race, but I think one of her other great performances was when she backed up from the 1,400-metre race at Caulfield and won the Lightning Stakes over 1,000 metres the following week. But well, you know, we were talking before the interview started about how well Peter Moody managed and placed that mare. She wasn't in cotton wool. They didn't have to run in the new market with 58. I think it was probably the most nervous outside of Royal Ascot that the owners ever were, because, you know, one of the great mares are always at advantage because they're better than the males anyway, but when they run in weight for age races, they get 2 kilos less. But whether it's Maccabi Diva carrying 58 and giving weight to everything in a Melbourne Cup, or Black Caviar carrying 58 and giving lots of weight to everything in a Newmarket, or Winx winning a Doncaster last year, or Sunline winning a Doncaster for that matter when she carried a big weight. I always think it's great that the connections want to test their mares in those great handicap races. And I think that's one of the great things about Australian racing. People say that weight for age is the truest test of the best horses. But handicap races is really the greatest test, because in those races they are giving weight to some very serious horses, and they do actually prove just how good they are.
Good point. Greg Carpenter, our guest this morning. This is Your Racing Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating life. Greg Carpenter talking with us this morning. This is Your Racing Life. The local market, and we look back over the last 6 months, and I couldn't make the press conference or the media gathering last week, Greg, for I had another appointment on the day, but the figures over the last 6 months from wagering to participation, etc., they're pretty healthy.
They're very healthy, Brian. I think one of the points Giles Thompson, our acting CEO, was very keen to inform the media just how strong Victorian racing is going at the moment. There's always a lot of discussion about issues in horse racing that people see as negative, and I think Giles was very keen to underline the strength of Victorian racing. You know, in what is a very competitive wagering market for horse racing right around the world, where most jurisdictions are battling to get any growth at all, Victorian racing is running at better than 6% in the first half of this year as far as turnover growth is concerned. It's very well documented that under Bernard Saundry's tenure, Racing Victoria was able to erase its debt and is now in a very sound financial position. And that strong position has continued over the first 6 months of this racing year. Turnover is very strong. Profitability from race meetings is very good. We were able to increase the minimum prize money from the 1st of February for most of our Saturday races to $100,000. We're looking at prize money increases again in 2017 and 18. So, again, the message for me is that when I came to Victoria, I came here because this was the pinnacle of horse racing in Australia. And I think the message is that it will continue to be the industry leader, and people can participate and invest in Victorian racing into the future with an extreme amount of confidence.
The return to owners is critical, of course, because of the costs involved, whether you're buying, leasing, it doesn't really matter. But at the end of the day, you're looking between $40,000 and $50,000 for a thoroughbred to be trained by the stables. And we've got to have a chance to be able to get some of that back, you know. Otherwise, it's a nonsense to keep going. You know, it's money down the drain. prize money and keeping up with what other states are doing, particularly New South Wales, and getting that return is got to be the way to go.
You'd have to say that New South Wales have done a remarkable job over the last 4 or 5 years. They've created the championships with the support of the state government. They put a lot of money into that, and I think that's going to be good for Australian racing that that carnival continues to grow and prosper. From the 1st of October, they increased their Saturday prize money to $100,000. Coming from Perth, I don't always get the New South Wales-Victorian rivalry, but I'm pretty sure that most people would say that they've thrown down the gauntlet to Victorian racing and its position as industry leader. Now, we have to be prudent and responsible about how we manage our industry going forward. It can't be always in response to New South Wales, but as I said, not everyone goes into horse racing to turn a profit or to make an enormous amount of money out of it. It's a great social experience, and I think, Brian, both you and I would understand that I've been in horse racing for 36 years and you for longer, that the nature of racing has changed. It's a great social experience now. There's big ownership groups and you've had experience putting those groups together. So a lot of it is just not about financial return and prize money. A lot of it is about being invested emotionally in a horse, whether you win a maiden at Bendigo or a race at Flemington or at Moonee Valley. It's just a great experience to A, have a runner, and B, to have a winner. But we do have to make sure that people want to keep reinvesting in the industry and that the financial returns are rewarding enough for them to keep going. You know, it's not all silver lining. My experience is that as I look around Australia, horse racing is facing a number of challenges. If you look at the starter numbers in some of the other states, it's small fields. So it's going to be a challenge into the rest of this century for racing in Australia to keep being as relevant and keep the participation levels that it has historically. But I hope that can happen throughout Australia. But as I said, certainly here in Victoria, we are really well placed to keep growing the sport, to keep growing the participation levels. And one of the other things that were highlighted, of course, last Friday at that press release was the female participation. Mm. You know, one of the driving focuses, a person who's got two daughters, one of which partner is a horse trainer in Perth. I understand that there are a lot of females in the industry, and we need to keep highlighting the achievements and make sure that they are comfortable to grow their participation in the sport, whether it's as an owner, a strapper, track work rider, jockey, or a trainer, or an administrator. And we've got a lot of female administrators in key positions here now at Racing Victoria, which is, I think, a great thing, because we've got to keep driving the inclusiveness and the diversity of the industry if it's going to be successful into the future.
Amanda Elliott has just been appointed, of course, chairman of the VRC, and that's a fantastic effort. Michelle Payne won the Melbourne Cup in 2015, and the participation of females within the industry, particularly through the jockeys and trainers, is extraordinary now.
Well, Michelle, we talked about Maccabi Diva being a great sporting story outside of racing, and Michelle was the same. For a female rider to win the Melbourne Cup was just a magnificent piece of sporting history. You know, the contribution that the Payne family have made and their history and all the challenges that they've had to go through are extraordinary, and it's wonderful that Michelle was rewarded with that victory. But she's only part of the story now. It certainly had the focus on her victory, but with riders like Caitlin Mallion, Jessica Payne, and some of the female riders that have been in it for a long time, Claire Lindop in Adelaide, Linda Meach here in Victoria, there is a growing number, and we certainly see it through the number of apprentices coming through here, again in Victoria, but also around Australia. The riding ranks of females are continuing to grow, and they're continuing to be competitive. One of the interesting parts of just going back internationally, one of the things that have come to the surface in the last 3 or 4 months, that they've just introduced a gender allowance for female riders in France. Yes, the French government convinced the racing jurisdiction in France to give all female riders what, not an apprentice allowance, but a gender allowance. Now, that was discussed a couple of years ago in Australia, and it was actually the female riders who were the first to shout it down because they feel that they compete on an even playing field as jockeys, and they want to prove themselves as the equal of all their competitors. One day we'll stop calling them female riders and they'll just be jockeys because they are very successful. The way the nature of riding is going with the reduced use of the whip is going to be even more play into the hands of female riders because they've got great hands, horses run for them, they've got a great affinity with the horse itself. So, you know, Michelle was the first. I think there'll be more into the future.
You spoke just before of one daughter, Ashley, being married to a trainer in the West. Tell us about your daughter, Janae, who's studying at Cambridge University.
Well, Janae's remarkable in my eyes, and we've talked about this. You know, everyone's proud of their children, but sometimes I'm blown away with what she has been able to achieve. It was a difficult situation when we first moved over to Melbourne because I took the job as chief handicapper here. Ashley had 2 years to go with high school, so Leanne and Ashley and Janae stayed in Perth while Ashley completed year 11 and 12, and then Leanne and Ashley and Janae moved over here. So Janae did her last 3 years of school in Melbourne, and she was happy to do that. She went to Melbourne University and did her arts degree there, then did an honours degree in criminology. She was the Dean's Honours List in her honours year. And then for the last couple of years worked at Melbourne University at the Nossal Institute, researching for professors and ended up running some of the second year criminology tutes. So she applied to Cambridge last year to do her master's program. She was given an early offer. She won the Charles Allen scholarship. So she's there, she's doing criminology. She's always been very sports-minded. She's a great netballer, and she got into Cambridge's first team, and I didn't realise, but certainly in England, to get what's called full blues, to represent Cambridge against Oxford or Oxford against Cambridge, is a big thing. So I took the liberty of taking 2 weeks to go to England over the last fortnight and coincided it with the Cambridge-Oxford game on February the 25th, and they won 47-41. So she's not there to play netball. She's there to get her her master's completed, and then she'll go on and do a PhD somewhere else in the world. But she's loving the opportunity to study at Cambridge, play sport there. Again, without boring the listeners, she's going to Whitemore Prison, which is the maximum security prison, one of the maximum security prisons in England, and doing some work there with long-term inmates. And she's achieved a lot, and her partner Diane Merkic produced a 12-minute short here in Melbourne last year called Silence, which is about a young female musician who's losing her hearing and the struggles that she has. And they completed that film here. They've entered it for film festivals around Europe, and also it won the jury prize at Montreal International Film Festival. Just on the weekend, it won Best International Film in Amsterdam, and it won Best Drama at the York Film Festival in England. So they're doing really well over there, and as I said, Janae, for a 25-year-old, she's already achieved a lot in her very short life.
Very proud dad, we all. Fantastic to catch up with you, and good racing today at Flemington. I can't wait for it to get cracking. And thanks for your time too, Greg. It's a career that you've achieved so much, and you're in the prime of your time, and may you have long life and enjoy your racing enormously.
Well, I've always enjoyed racing, Brian. I've been very lucky to fall into this, really, and it's brought me a lot of joy, and certainly I just love going to the races, as we all do, and that's what keeps us interested and so passionate about the industry in which we work.
Greg Carpenter, our guest this morning on This Is Your Racing Life.